Could we start the interview with like how the Fifth Beatle started?
Yeah, so I first discovered the Brian Epstein story, or I guess I should say I started to uncover the Brian Epstein story literally 20-something years ago when I was at business school. So literally, you know, I think I can say I've been working on this project for more than half my life. I turned 41 this year, and I probably started researching this about 22, 23 years ago. So I was at the Wharton School of Business, and I was dreaming about a career in the arts and entertainment industry. And back then, Wharton didn't really have the education was amazing, but it didn't really have any resources for somebody who was interested in working in the arts. And so I sort of found myself needing to do that kind of study on my own. And being a lifelong Beatles fan and thinking that the Beatles were the group that kind of wrote and then rewrote the rules of the pop music business, I thought if I'm going to work in the entertainment business and in the music business, it'd be a good place to start by studying the management and the business of the Beatles. And this is, you know, 22, 23 years ago. And I know I'm dating myself here, but, you know, back then there's no Wikipedia, there's no YouTube, there's no Google, you know, there are none of these kind of online resources that we so take for granted today. And there are no books about Brian Epstein. I mean, quite literally, The Fifth Beatle is the only book in print, graphic novel or otherwise about Brian. To give credit where it's due, there's a wonderful biography that's been out of print for a number of years, for well over a decade, called The Man Who Made the Beatles. And, it's been out of print, I'm sorry, for about two decades. And when I wanted to find it, when I began my research, I had to do a rare book search, and it showed up 3 months later. And nowadays, you can find it quite easily on Amazon Marketplace and Abe Books and any number of used book websites. And it is wonderful. It is a bit of a doorstop and an encyclopedia. So it's not the easiest read. And it's also written by Ray Coleman, who's a wonderful, he passed away, but he was a wonderful, rock biographer. But he was also very close with Brian, which is great in some respects, for obvious reasons. You know, to be close to your subject, you get certain elements of truth and intimacy that you are not with somebody who doesn't have that kind of access. But you also don't get the most unfiltered version of the story. You know, there's a number of elements about Brian's life that Ray, being a close friend, you know, either didn't want to talk about or glossed over, or you know, being somebody who grew up, you know, after Epstein passed away and just has been looking to learn from his life story, I think I have a very different perspective. But anyway, going back to the beginning, I know it's a very long-winded answer to your question, but I hope it'll be interesting. Going back to the beginning, I began the study, and I was finding it rather impossible. You know, no books about Brian, no online resources, you know, none of the stuff that we have today. And even if you start that study today, you'd find that outside of the Fifth Beatle, there's very little known about Brian Epstein. So I had no choice but to interview people who knew him. You know, that was the only recourse I had. So I basically got my hands on every respected Beatles book I could find, and I'd read these 200, 300 page books about the Beatles, and I would wind up getting, you know, 10 good pages about Brian. But I slowly figured out who were the people in his life that knew him best. And I basically, you know, pulled a phone book off the shelf, and I looked up the contact information of folks who knew Brian, who lived, you know, within a two-hour radius of New York and Philadelphia. I was going to school in Philly, and I was from New York, and I just cold called these people. You know, people like Sid Bernstein, the legendary concert promoter who brought the band over to the U.S., and Nat Weiss, who was the band's first U.S. attorney and became Brian Epstein's best friend. And anyway, long story short, you know, these folks all eventually agreed to talk to me. I was so excited when I reached out to them. What I always say is I was so excited I forgot to be intimidated. I just cold called them, and I said, I'm a young person looking for information about Brian Epstein, who the little bit I know has been inspiring to me. And not one of them turned me away. And it was amazing. It was amazing. And I started by getting the Beatles stories, which is what I was really after. You know, wanting to, you know, how did he get the band a record deal when no one wanted to sign them? How did he convince Ed Sullivan to book them when a British band had never made an impact in the United States? How did he come up with the suits and the haircuts? You know, these were the stories I was after. And they're, you know, if you've read the book, you know they're in the book and they're fascinating stories. But what I really uncovered, which I will be the first to admit is not something I was even looking for when I began this study, was the human side of his story. You know, the fact that he was gay and Jewish and from Liverpool. And in the 1960s, those were three massive obstacles. You know, it was against the law to be gay. It was literally a felony. Anti-Semitism was prevalent in the country. And Liverpool, prior to the Beatles, was a port town with no cultural influence to speak of. So in Brian, you've got the ultimate outsider. You've got the least likely guy to succeed in his chosen field. And that was incredibly inspiring to me as a young person of Indian origin who didn't want to join his family business, didn't want to become a doctor or an engineer the way most Indian kids are steered towards. You know, having a role model of somebody who pursued an unorthodox career choice for his ethnicity was very, very inspiring to me. And that's, you know, it's a very long answer to your question, but the question is kind of a big one. You know, how did the Fifth Beatle all start? You know, because it's not just about like, well, I'm a Beatles fan and I wanted to know how they got signed. You know, that would be an easy answer to the question, and that I guess is how it started. Like most people, I think, who will come to this story, I got sucked in by the Beatles because I was a Beatles fan. But like, if I do my job correctly with the Fifth Beatle, the people who are coming out of the story will realize, you know, it's not really about the Beatles. It's this wonderful human story about a guy who went the distance despite the obstacles against him, you know?
I totally understand what you're saying. I mean, because I'm a Beatles fan myself, and you and I are actually a month apart as far as age. So I'm actually like a month or so older than you. So,
so you know the deal, yeah. You know?
Well, here's the thing. I've always been a Beatles fan as well. Ever since I was a kid, my parents turned me on to it because my mom was a Beatles fan, you know?
Ditto. That's how I got into them, you know?
Well, and how I never knew about Brian Epstein until the Beatles anthology miniseries came out on ABC. Mm-hmm. You remember that? And it was February 95, and then they released the anthology series of albums with the new, you know, with the Free as a Bird, and, you know, where they finished the tracks on two other Beatles songs. And he intrigued me after that, but you're right. I mean, there was nothing on this man for years and years and years. And, what your last answer actually brings another question to mind. Had Brian Epstein not died, what do you think his role in the Beatles would have been? Because he died at a time when they had stopped touring and started recording Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple things in your question. You know, the first something that's sort of tied into that, you know, his role with the band is like, you know, a lot of people have more bluntly asked, you know, were they going to fire him? You know, was he going to still be their manager? Or putting it more kindly, you know, was he still useful to them that since they had stopped touring? And, you know, I have been researching this story literally for over two decades, and there is absolutely nothing in my research that has suggested that the Beatles were going to fire Brian. I mean, they adored him. You know, he was there from the very beginning. You know, Paul McCartney has famously said, if anyone was the Fifth Beatle, it was Brian, which we slap on every marketing material we have. It's a wonderful quote. But if you go on to read the rest of the quote, Paul continues to say, you know, a lot of people give that title to George Martin. And while George Martin had a great influence on the Beatles and their sound, you know, by the time the Beatles had got to George Martin, they were already a fully formed band. They were professional. They had a look. They had a style. They had an image. You know, they had a lot of the stuff worked out. And so they were able to present to George Martin sort of the complete package. But when Brian joined the band, so to speak, when he became part of the Beatles family, they had nothing. They were rough and tumble. They were unprofessional. They didn't have a look. They were smoking and drinking on stage. They didn't know what they were doing.
Wasn't Pete Best and Stuart Sutcliffe still in the band at that time?
Stu Sutcliffe was not, but okay. Pete Best was.
Okay.
The band had just come back from Hamburg, having lost Stuart to a girl. You know, I mean, literally, they were like, the band had exhausted whatever opportunities they had in Liverpool. They went over to Hamburg and did a stint in Germany and had returned to Liverpool having gotten kicked out of the country and having lost their bass player to a girl. I mean, wow. It's a common story among bands, you know, yeah. Right? I mean, band member leaves because he for a girl.
You would never,
you know,
when you think about it
like that, these guys had hit a ceiling when Brian Epstein joined the band, you know?
Yeah, they could easily think they were on their way down when they met him.
And they did, you know, I don't know if I would go so far as to say they thought they were on their way down, but they had definitely felt that they reached the ceiling. I mean, they were frustrated. They were at the end of their rope. You know, they did not think that the world was their oyster. They were like, we don't know what else to do. You know,
and those the Hamburg sessions. I mean, those gigs were kind of violent too. I mean, you had
crazy
because I remember seeing on, you know, like I said in the anthology series, how they were. The audience was throwing chairs and fighting, and I mean this. I mean, it almost sounded like they were Sex Pistols gigs and not early Beatles gigs.
Totally. No, you're absolutely. I mean, and yeah. it's you know, the Sex Pistols are probably my second favorite band in the world.
Yeah, mine too.
And I don't think it's a coincidence. I don't think they're actually that different. You know, the Beatles were kind of the Sex Pistols of their time. You know, they were four punks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Brian cleaned them up and made them palatable to the world. And then as soon as like everybody embraced them, they went back to being radical, you know, but they were punks. They were early punk rockers. Well,
Lennon and Lydon have shared a lot of the same views.
Totally.
You know, and, you know, it's just, I think that if they were closer in age, I think they would have actually probably been friends.
Yeah, who knows? I wouldn't be surprised if they are, you know, despite all the rabble-rousing, nasty things Johnny Rotten has said about the Beatles. I mean, that guy will say anything to get a rise. I wouldn't be surprised if they're closet friends, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, and then the other side of the coin is, like, this whole thing about, like, the band had stopped touring, right? And so you know, was there any... So, right off the bat, the Beatles loved Brian. They thought of him as somebody that was there from the very beginning. There's nothing in any of my research that suggests that they thought he was useless or undeserving or did anything untoward with their business. There's nothing to suggest that they would have fired him, first of all. Now, the second thing about, like, so the band had started touring, right? So there was nothing for Brian to do. So, you know, maybe his usefulness for the band was expiring. Well, that's ludicrous, you know, and I think you'll appreciate this, especially, you know, with what you do and how you cover developing artists and whatnot through Jammerzine, and anyone who understands anything about bands and the music industry, it's like, you know, let's look at it this way. It's like, you know, I guess when Metallica isn't touring, there must be nothing for their manager to do. Right? Or let's use a more popular example. When Justin Timberlake isn't making records, there must be nothing for his manager to do. It's preposterous, right? I mean, like, when you reach that level, you're making movies, you're writing books, you're doing clinics, you're like, I mean, you're fashion icons. I mean, there's a million things to do. Yeah.
On top of that, there is no monogamy in that business. Think about it. Like, if you look at, like, well, if you look at Metallica or Justin Timberlake, they probably, you know, have people that know each other that work together themselves.
That's exactly right, you know, and Metallica's not a bad example, you know, like, you know, they took time off to record an orchestral record with the San Francisco Symphony, you know, like, you know, their manager had a ton of shit to do surrounding that project, just the same way Brian Epstein, okay, they stopped touring. Do you think Sgt. Pepper's was an easy record to make? They hired an entire symphony to record A Day in the Life. Who do you think had to deal with that? Brian Epstein had to deal with that. You know, that when they put an album cover together, including, you know, a score of famous people, they had to get permission from either the people or their estates in the case of people who'd passed away. Brian Epstein had to get okays from every single person on the album cover of Sgt. Pepper's. I mean, there was a tremendous amount of stuff for the guy to do, you know, and also... Putting this in Beatles historical perspective, you know, the band stopped touring also coming off of things like the Philippines tour. And you'll see I covered that in my book in a cartoon fashion. And the reason I covered it in cartoon fashion is because that was a moment in time where the band's career kind of got cartoony. You know, they went to the Philippines. They inadvertently snubbed Imelda Marcos. She pulled security. They got chased out of the country, like literally by the Filipino army. I mean, it's like, you know, when I talk about this, I always say, like, you know, if you've seen Argo, which is a true story, you know in that last sequence they're kind of like running down the tarmac and they're jumping into the plane and they're pulling away, you know, barely getting onto the plane. you know, it's a wonderful true story. And the one of the few things that's not true in Argo is that last sequence. You know, that, you know, Ben Affleck kind of made that up and because it worked for Hollywood. You know, well, that actually happened to the Beatles. Like, that's how it was. They were literally running down the tarmac in a Jeep. You know, it was like things got crazy. I mean, and Brian Epstein literally broke out into hives in the wake of that tour. It literally affected his physical health. So I wouldn't be surprised if when the Beatles said they stopped touring, Brian Epstein sighed a breath of relief. You know, like, I don't think it was like, oh gosh, there must be nothing for me to do. It must be like, oh, thank God, we don't need to deal with that anymore.
Exactly. You know? Well, don't you, you know what I always pictured Brian doing was working, like, doing more for the Apple label.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, maybe, like, because, I mean...
Look, I mean, the thing that's sad is what I think he would have been doing is things that we can't even imagine. You know, he would have been pushing the band into new realms, you know, in much the same way that the most creative bands end up doing all sorts of different things. Like these days, you see bands like Metallica recording with Lou Reed and a symphony orchestra. Sting is doing a Broadway musical. I mean, you just see these artists like pushing themselves into new boundaries. And I think that's what Brian would have done for the Beatles. I mean, in the Beatles day and age, you have to remember, like, for a band to write their own songs was radical. I mean, bands didn't write their own material before the Beatles. So, you know, Brian would have encouraged them to act, to become bigger fashion icons, to maybe become political correspondents. I mean, who knows what he might have had them doing. But I think it would have been something unusual. It would have been something that we can't predict.
Yeah. Well, and if you remember, too, the Beatles were one of the first pioneers of the music video.
Totally.
You know, because I remember I remember all those videos like Strawberry Fields and, you know, Rubber, and you know, like I Am the Walrus, all that stuff. I mean, like they were doing it, you know, 15 years before MTV came around.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Totally.
Well, let me ask you this.
I mean, A Hard Day's Night is really one long music video. I mean, that's really what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or several music videos strung together with little, like, Thriller, you know, moments, like Michael Jackson's Thriller, you know, like that video. I mean, that's really what Hard Day's Night is. It's one long music video with little bits of narrative joining the videos.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. In a way, the movie is a soundtrack for the album.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You know, well, I've got a question for you. Since you and I are such Beatles fans and we both know what the world thinks of the Beatles, do you think there's any successor to the Beatles? Or do you think that, or do you think those days are gone?
You know, I think that, you know, the Beatles, when they came out, were initially like a youth band. You know, they were embraced by the youth before they crossed over to being loved by all ages. You know, and in the same way, you know, I think the Beatles of the future, whoever that it will be determined and led by the youth, which is a fancy way of saying, like, I'm an old fucker. You know, yeah. Like, I'm 41, man. You know, I'm not going to be able to tell you who the next Beatles are. You know, and I mean that, you know, because when the Beatles came out, you know, and became popular immediately, they were a boy band. You know, they really were. They were the cute one, the shy one, the funny one, the intellectual one, you know, the rebel, you know, that they were, you know, the Spice Girls. I mean, they were, you know, the Spice Girls were kind of modeled after the Beatles. I mean, as much as that might sound crazy, it's true, you know? And so with that in mind, like, I don't follow those groups, so I don't know. Like, I don't listen to One Direction. Could it be One Direction? Maybe. Could it be some band I've never heard of because I'm not 15 and listening to pop music? Maybe. You know, the test of it will be which of these groups can grow from becoming a popular band with the 13, 14-year-olds and grow and end up doing something artistically interesting. And, you know, 50 years after they were making cheesy boy band records are still relevant, you know? And maybe there is a band who's doing that now. If there is, I don't know who they are.
You know what's funny? I mean, I get into this argument a lot with people, and I hear a lot of people mention that, say, well, the only thing I can think of, or the only band I can think of since then would be U2. And I'm like, I don't agree with that, because U2 didn't, like, blow up. They gradually came up to where they are.
Yeah, I mean, to me, look, I'm a U2 fan as well, and
but they were never a boy band either.
Yeah, and the thing about U2 is, like, they, to me, I mean, you know, they deserve, they're rock and roll legends, they belong in the Hall of Fame, they're, you know, they have a place in rock history. I happen to also be a fan, you know, I can't say anything bad about U2, so please don't take this the wrong way. But I feel like the difference is that U2, while certainly they've pushed envelopes in certain ways, Oxen maybe might, you know, kind of came out of left field, but I feel like U2 have been consistent. You know, where the Beatles, like, from record to record, have been sort of like making radical shifts. You know, to me, the Beatles went from, you know, if you look at Boy and you look at Octung Baby, like, it's not that hard to imagine the band that did Boy growing up and doing Octung
Baby.
They
still had their core sound.
And that's no disrespect, you know? But if you listen to Please Please Me and then listen to, like, you know, Helter Skelter, I mean, it's like, really? Is that the same group? It's like almost impossible to imagine. And I feel like that's what the Beatles have got on bands like U2. And that is no disrespect to U2. It really isn't. I can't underscore that enough. I don't mean that in a
A compliment, because they kept their core sound, and their core sound is what defines them.
Yeah, and to be consistently great the way U2 has, I mean, certainly they've had songs that aren't as good as other songs, but more or less, the band has been consistently great for decades. That's amazing. That's an incredible feat. But what the Beatles did, to me, is really unprecedented. And however, it doesn't mean that it can't be done again. And the real test will be time. You know, what's remarkable about the Beatles is the fact that, like, here we are 50 years after they first touched down on American shores, and we're still celebrating their successes. So, you know what? Like, you know, let's see when you and I are 90, you know, 50 years from now, you know, if One Direction have gone on to become legendary, and you and I are maybe scratching our heads a little bit, maybe they will have been the next Beatles. I don't know, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know what I think is great, too? That the fifth Beatle was recently sent to the Library of Congress. I mean, I think that is just crazy.
How cool is that?
I mean, that is like, you know, an artist version of the Medal of Honor.
It was amazing, you know, and we're also in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Library and Archives.
Exactly.
And those two accomplishments to me are so amazing. You know, Library of Congress and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Library, I mean, right on.
Did they just call you up and ask you, or what? I mean, how does that happen?
Pretty much. I mean, they just, you know, out of the blue, we got a note saying, you know, the Library of Congress would like you to invite you to become a part of a book festival, and the book will be, you know, added to our archives. It was incredible. And I should say it is wonderful and somewhat groundbreaking, but the Library of Congress are more and more embracing graphic novels. I'm proud to say that we are one of a few. I mean, there were four. I mean, it's not many. There were only four, but we were one of four graphic novels that were represented this year, and it was incredible that we were one. And not for nothing, the only one that was music related. So I think that's really cool.
That's very cool, because it shows that they're opening their eyes to more diversity in art.
Totally.
I mean, but that was going to be my next question. I mean, you know, that the book is a graphic novel, and it was asked to be inducted, but also that the book is less than a year old.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
You know?
It's incredible. I mean, we are coming up. The book was released in the States on November 18th, so we're coming up on our 1 year anniversary in about a month. It's amazing the response this book has had in the first year. You know, people ask me often, like, you know, did you see it coming? Could you have imagined? And the truth is, like, on one hand, you know, I knew that the Brian Epstein story was special. You know, it's inspired me my entire life, and I knew that it was a largely untold story, that if you wanted to learn it, this was the only way you could. And taking myself out of the equation, I knew that the artwork on the book, which I had nothing to do with, you know, I'm the writer, not the artist. You know, I knew that the artwork in the book was gorgeous.
Oh, it is.
And I really did believe in my heart of hearts that we would get there, that one day this book had the potential to be a New York Times bestseller. It had the potential to, you know, to capture the imagination of a lot of different types of peoples, of the gay community, the Jewish community, the Beatles fans, the comic fans. I really did feel that we would get there, but I must say that I never, ever in my wildest dreams expected we would do all that in our first year. you know, I never thought we would debut on the New York Times bestsellers. I thought, like, one day, maybe years from now, the book will be a bestseller. But right off the bat, in its first week, it totally blindsided me. And all these awards, you know, obviously awards are given to the books of the year. And I didn't expect we'd win any awards because I thought that this book would get there eventually. I didn't think we would get there in year one. So it's been a really overwhelming, happy, humbling. It's been all of those things.
And well, and you picked a great cartoonist too. You know, Kyle Baker.
Kyle's amazing.
Oh my God. No, I used to get into his stuff back in the Marvel comic days.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, and you know what's funny? I mean, he's got that signature style. But you know what is great? Like flipping through the book, the pages reflect the mood of that instant.
Mm-hmm.
And when he first meets the Beatles, it's dark, you know, and everything else, but the lighting's there, and then, you know, the lighting's coming from the center, and it, you know, just focuses on his face and, you know, and his utter amazement. And then later on, when, you know, things fall apart for him, the drawing or the artwork turns dark. I mean, he framed the moods perfect.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Andrew is. I mean, they're both amazing. But those shift from light to dark. You know, that's really seen in Andrew's pages.
Oh, okay.
And Andrew. Yeah. So
yeah, you're talking to Andrew Robinson. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So Andrew Robinson is the artist who did the entire book except for the Philippine sequence.
Okay.
So Kyle Baker did the Philippine sequence, which is the very cartoony. You know, that side of Kyle Baker's art.
Okay.
But the rest of the book is Andrew Robinson. So the credit for that sort of shift from light to dark really belongs to Andrew.
Okay, I'm sorry, Andrew. Andrew Robinson.
No, I won't tell him. Your secret's safe with me. I mean, Kyle is brilliant. You know, and much like you, I've been watching, looking at Kyle's stuff since I was a kid as well. But that part of the book is really Andrew. And I would say it's also based on sort of my general notes, although Andrew, you know, really took it and brought it to life. But when I was thinking of structuring the Brian Epstein story, you know, the first decision I made was that I wanted to focus on the years he spends with the Beatles. You know, that's why we call it the Fifth Beatle. So it starts off in 1961 in Liverpool, and it ends in 1967 in London. So 1961 Liverpool is, it's dark, gray, drab, rainy, depressing. It's, you know, or a little depressing, I should say. So I saw that as being very black and white. And it ends in 1967 London, which is the summer of love. It's the birth of the psychedelic era. You know, there's literally an event in London that year called A Technicolor Dream. So I viewed the arc of the Brian Epstein story as mirroring the arc of the movement from black and white to color. And that might not make sense to anyone but me, but you could see I was thinking in terms of changing color palette, and that's something I really wanted to play with. So I told Andrew, you know, I want the first several pages of the book to be not necessarily black and white, but very muted, very black, white, gray, blue, very washed out. And then when we see the Beatles, I want it to be literally, you know, a poetic a version of the Beatles inject color into Brian's otherwise black and white life. And, you know, we get our first bursts of orange, red, yellow. And then by the time we get to the book, you know, we're in full-on Technicolor. And so at the end of Brian's life, rather than having it be like a fade to black, you know, I thought of it as let's explode to white. It's almost like he gets consumed with color, you know, and that's, or maybe not consumed, or the color, you know, he gets lost in all of that, and the color is drained. The color goes away, and we explode to white.
Like,
you know?
like the Vacation in Spain sequence. I mean, that's like washed out with color almost.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, yeah, I you know what's funny? I didn't notice that consciously until you pointed that out.
Andrew and I, I'm glad that you didn't, because it's not supposed to be noticed consciously. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be sort of felt subconsciously. Mm-hmm. But that's how Andrew and I discussed it.
But I think that helps dictate your feeling as you're reading the story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so well, let's talk about your Broadway work. I've always wondered how do you become a Broadway producer, and what is that job like? And that, I mean, that has to conflict with your career as a writer just because of the time.
Yeah, it has been very challenging. I mean, not coincidentally, you know, while I've been writing The Fifth Beatle, you know, I haven't done another Broadway project in a while. You know, while I was developing The Fifth Beatle, I was developing The Addams Family and Green Day's American Idiots, and they both wound up launching at the same time, but I did not think that was going to happen. I thought those two were going to be staggered out at various different periods. But you're absolutely right. One of my biggest challenges as a writer was really just finding the time. You know, I love writing, and if I could spend all my time doing it, I would. But production is also a very encompassing field, and that's why right now I just have one Broadway project, which is that it's very early stages. I'm working with Alanis Morissette to adapt Jagged Little Pill for the stage. And that's really quite strictly, I'm not looking to do another Broadway project right now, just because I, you know, have my hands full with The Fifth Beatle, and as you probably know, we're adapting The Fifth Beatle into a film, and I wrote the screenplay myself, and so I need to be very, very focused on that. You know, how I got into Broadway, I grew up in New York City, right here in the city, and my parents were lovers of the arts, and ever since I was a little kid, they were exposing me to all different kinds of the arts, including Broadway. So I grew up with a real love of Broadway, in addition to a love of punk rock. You know, I mean, it was a really interesting duality. I grew up on 12th Street, and my mom, you know, was constantly taking me uptown to places like, you know, Times Square to see Broadway shows, as well as to Lincoln Center to see opera and ballet. And then as soon as I was allowed out of the house on my own, I was going downtown to see, you know, punk rock shows and, you know, bands like the Ramones and Murphy's Law and Leeway and bands like that. And then I saw early Sonic Youth shows. And the birth of sort of that, you know, experimental garage rock, and back then every other venue in the Lower East Side was either a rock club or an experimental theater house when the sun went down. So it was really, I grew up kind of loving it all, you know.
Yeah, because you do a lot of stuff involving music. I'm not just talking about the Fifth Beatle or the Green Day player Alanis Morissette, but you also do you've done like Punk Rock Dad. Uh-huh. I remember that, and you've worked with Mel Brooks a bunch of a few times, and he incorporates music like the producers, so on and so forth. I mean, yeah.
Music is at the core of everything I do. I mean, it is my first love. You know, I've been working for myself for 15 years, but before that I worked for record labels, so I come out of the music industry. You know, the only project I've worked on that doesn't have a musical core per se is A Raisin in the Sun, and even that, you know, we cast Sean Combs, you know, P. Diddy as our male lead, and we marketed that show like you would market a hip-hop record. We hired street teams, we did radio promotion, we did, like, all sorts of things that you just don't do for a Broadway show. You don't hire street teams to market a Broadway show. We did for A Raisin in the Sun. You know, so music really is, it's my first and dearest love.
Well, and not only that, but you've gotten big enough now, it's the point where you've got your own production company, you know, Tiwari Group, Entertainment
Group. Yeah, Tiwari Entertainment Group, yeah.
Yeah. So you're not just doing it yourself anymore. I mean, you've got a crew.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because like Tiwari Entertainment Group, really, in terms of full-time employees, it's you. it's me and my assistant Lenora.
Wow.
You know, I mean, but that being said, you know, every project that we work on, we have a number of partners, and more increasingly, these are long-time trusted partners, you know, people we've done work with before and that we love and like. So I would say the TEG extended family is quite extensive. But in terms of, like, you know, to say like you have a crew, it's like, well, we really don't. You know, we just have lots of friends and trusted partners, and you know, as we pick new projects, we you know, we go to our various partners to see who makes sense, or who makes the most sense to work with on a particular project.
Yeah. Now, I know you have plans to make The Fifth Beatle a feature film, but have you thought about bringing this to Broadway? Because that would make a really great Broadway play.
It's nice that you would say that. You know, I have to be honest, when I first started thinking about the Brian Epstein story, you know, I wanted nothing more than to do it as a theater project, if only because that was my primary background. You know, it was the world at the time that I knew the best. I mean, now I am, you know, I'm very knee-deep in film, and obviously I've become a very successful graphic novelist. And I grew up reading comics, but I had never done it before, you know, so I would have loved to have done this as a stage play or a stage musical, but the truth is I couldn't see it. Like, every time I tried to envision it that way, it just didn't make sense to me. It felt much more like a film than a graphic novel, which is why I pursued those angles. That being said, you know, theater is in my blood, and it's certainly where I made my first mark in the entertainment industry. And so, you know, I would love to see maybe it cycle back around to theater, and maybe after, you know, a film director gets their hands on it and add the unique spin to it there, maybe it'll be clearer to me how it could be done as a stage musical. And maybe it will be there eventually. But, you know, there's also something to be said for focus and one thing at a time. And then really right now we're just very focused on the film.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it would make a great stage production, but I mean, I think it would also make a great film. I'm just glad that Epstein's getting his due in a way.
Indeed.
You know, because like I said, you know, we started following Epstein right around the same time. You obviously took it much, much, much further than I did. I just researched some stuff just because I was curious for myself. But he's a major figure in the history of the Beatles. He's like the lost father almost, or the lost big brother. And I don't know about you, but with me, you know, the more I read about him in the late 90s, it kind of made me mad that Pete Best and Stuart Sutcliffe and even George Martin got more publicity than he did.
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, I've sort of long gotten over this, getting upset about it, and like, should Brian's story have been told a long time ago? And it's like, you know what, like, let's just focus on the good stuff. Like, it's being told now, you know. He got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. There's a theater in Liverpool named after him. The Fifth Beatle is a number one New York Times bestseller, Eisner Award winner. You know, it's being adapted into a film. There's been a successful play on the West End of in London called Epstein. You know, it's his time has come, you know. And you know, academically speaking, like, should it have been told 20 years ago? Like, because I'm such a huge Brian Epstein champion, of course I would say, like, it would have been great. But I also sort of think that, though, that, like, that this is the time, you know, that his is really at its core the story of a gay Jew from Liverpool who went the distance, you know. And I think, you know, while we still have a long way to go in the world, we're much more tolerant than we were 10 years ago, you know. And 10 years ago, I don't know if the world, the mainstream world, would have been ready to hear an inspiring story about a gay Jew, you know. You know, I think there would have been, I can speak for America, and I think there were large swaths of America that would have immediately tuned out. You know, if I say, hey, check it out, I got this amazing story to tell you about this gay Jewish man who blah, 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 they, you know, a large chunk of America would have tuned right out after gay Jew.
And that's the sad part.
Not for me. And you know what? There's still a chunk of America that will, but that's an increasingly smaller chunk, you know? Yeah.
And that's the sad part, too, because that's not who he was. That's not who any of us are. We're not.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't really think we should be defined by our sexuality or our religion, because there's all types and all groups.
And it comes
down to the type of person you are and how you treat others. You know, that's how I look at it. And that's what I like about, you know, works like the Fifth Beatle is they're not, it's, you know, yeah, he's a gay Jew, but he's also a manager. He's also a friend. He's also a caregiver. He's also a creative genius. I mean, we could go on and on. And the more you go on, the smaller gay and Jew, you know, have to fit.
Yeah, that's right.
And that literally just becomes, oh, that's just a part of him. That's just, you know, one little facet or two little facets of this giant picture of who he was. You know, and it's not even a defining aspect, you know, in my opinion.
I agree entirely. So,
but I think you're right. I think the world is wising up, and I think that we are growing up as a society, and I think, you know, I'm glad it's acceptable that we don't dismiss people on a few things that some people don't personally have offense to that doesn't hurt anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm
here, brother.
Yeah, I know. I'm glad you brought that up. So, well, let's talk about the future. What do you have coming up? What does Vivek have coming up?
Yeah, so the main thing that I'm working on, it continues to be the Fifth Beatle, and it's the film. As you may know, we are very proud to have received music rights. So we are able to use Beatles songs in our film. We are the first and only film in history to have secured access to Beatles music. If you look at other, film about the band. In other words, you know, there have been other Beatles films, but films like Backbeat, Nowhere Boy. There was an MTV VH1 film called Two of Us about a fictional day in the life between John and Paul. And if you look at any of these movies, none of them have Beatles songs in it. So it's a huge honor.
Or they were re-recorded by some other artist.
Well, no. All those movies that I'm talking about have no Beatles composition.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they some of them got away with it, like Backbeat, which in large part focuses on the band's days in Hamburg. They were playing a lot of cover songs. So, it's got Roll Over Beethoven and Twist and Shout and, a number of songs that the Beatles didn't write, but played extensively. But if you look at those films, like songs that Lennon McCartney wrote or that are Harrison or Starr compositions, you won't find a single one.
Yeah, I know, now that you mention that, I never thought of that until you said something, actually.
Yeah, and that's because the band has never approved the script before. So the fact that that Paul, Ringo, Yoko, and Olivia Harrison have approved our script is, it's a huge honor and also a huge responsibility. It's one that we're not taking lightly. We intend to do right by Brian. And we are on track to shoot in 2015, next year. So I'm very excited about that. And
do you have any casting announcements?
We are into that right now, and unfortunately, okay. I can't tell you what we're thinking. I hope within the next handful of months, we'll be able to make an announcement.
Well, let me ask you this: Are you on track on getting who you want, or who you picture?
Yeah. Yes, we are on track. The film is certainly coming together the way that I would like. It's taken a lot longer than I would like, but that's the best things and always come with hard work and time. So I'm not upset about that. But I've been working on this for a very long time, and if you'd been tracking me for a while, I would have said, oh, we're going to shoot in 2012, and that was 2 years ago, and we still haven't shot. So I feel like a little bit of a broken record to say we're on track to shoot in 2015, but this time we really are. And we just have an incredible amount of momentum with the success of the graphic novel, and yes, we are. Everything is going wonderfully with the film. I really cannot complain. If you have a chance to give some plugs, to please tell your readers or your listeners that if they want more film news, they should just keep in touch with us through Facebook. We're at the Fifth Beatle on Facebook, and we're on Twitter at Fifth Beatle, and we also have a website with a mailing list and an active community at fifthbeatle.com. So that is the main thing that I have going. The other thing that I'm working on, as I mentioned briefly, is I'm working with Alanis Morissette to adapt Jagged Little Pill for the stage. We're in discussions with writers right now, so we're really at the very beginning stages of that. We don't even have a writer attached yet, although I do hope by the end of this year to be able to announce our writer, so it's very exciting. And then I love writing, and I've got some more writing projects coming up, and I can't get into too many details, but I would say the main thing that I'm working on is a young adult science fiction story, a young adult science fiction novel, I guess. It will include quite a bit of art, so an art from the comics community, so I'm not leaving my comics colleagues for a different medium, although it is not a graphic novel, it is a more traditional novel, but it will, as I said, have an art component to it.